Hey there, listeners. Before we begin, I wanted to let you know that since we're talking about Brexit today, we connected with a couple international guests, and we had a little connectivity trouble with one of our guests, so the audio is spotty in places. Nevertheless, it was a really interesting conversation, and we hope you can forgive any of the audio difficulties. Here it is. Enjoy the show. Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast, Brexit Edition. I'm Galen Druk, and today we are going to take a breather from American politics and head across the pond to the United Kingdom. It doesn't feel like it's all that often that America's political drama actually gets overshadowed, but the UK is doing a pretty good job of it this week. On Monday, Prime Minister Theresa May postponed a parliamentary vote on a deal to leave the European Union. By Wednesday, May's own Conservative Party had triggered a vote of no confidence against her, which she survived. Now, Theresa May is in Brussels at an EU summit to try to keep maybe negotiating parts of the Brexit deal. And if you don't know what any of this means, you're not alone. Don't worry, we're going to try to break it all down for you and maybe discuss some of the bigger questions about what this whole fiasco says about democracy and the political era that we're living in. I am not an expert enough on British politics to do that on my own, so I've asked two professors from the University of Cambridge to help. They have a politics podcast of their own in the UK called Talking Politics. First, we have Professor of Political Economy, Helen Thompson. Hi, Helen. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Dan. Hi.
And we also have Professor of Politics, David Runciman. Hi, David.
Hey.
Just out of the gates, I'm curious. I know you also discuss American politics on your podcast. So I have to ask, if you had to pick from a political science perspective, which country has more interesting politics right now?
I mean, I'm someone who spent a lot of time in the last 30 years, probably, engaged with American politics. I always found it exciting, dramatic. But what's going on in British politics right now, because it's simultaneously a story about constitutional questions, about economic questions, it's about geopolitical questions, it's about divisions within the political parties, it's about long repressed history in terms of the union coming back, pretty much is as dramatic as it gets.
David, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you like a perfect storm, we've got the perfect storm. I was struck that the New York Times put Theresa May winning a vote of confidence ahead of the president's lawyer going to jail, given that the vote didn't change anything. I think I might have reversed the order of those two stories. But I think deep down, I'm more interested in what's happening in your country. But I think at the moment, if you like suspense and you don't want to know what's going to happen next, we're the place to be.
Okay, so let's begin with what happened on Wednesday. We don't have confidence votes in America, I guess, other than regularly scheduled elections. How common are they? How big of a deal are they for party leadership? And why was this one in particular triggered?
So we need to distinguish there's a formal vote of no confidence in a government, and then there's the vote of no confidence in the party leader, which is what this vote was, on behalf of, in this case, the Conservative Party, the party's MPs. Those votes are pretty rare. I mean, Helen can correct me, but a vote of confidence in the party leader when that party's in government hasn't happened since John Major more than 20 years ago. Am I right?
Yeah, you're right. You could say that it's happened to three of the last four Conservative prime ministers, because Thatcher faced one as well. That's how she was deposed. So Cameron, of the recent four Conservative prime ministers, who hasn't faced a party vote of confidence.
And the big difference, when John Major did it, he called it himself. He called the vote of no confidence himself, in the sense that he resigned as leader of the Conservative Party, put himself up for re-election to try and flush out his opponents, and it half succeeded, half didn't. This one was obviously a straightforward attempt by her opponents to unseat her.
Was this triggered specifically because of Brexit?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, there is context that goes beyond Brexit, in the sense that is that there's been a section of the Conservative Party that's been deeply unhappy with it ever since the Conservatives lost the majority at the last general election in 2017. But the immediate trigger, 100% Brexit.
But then the other way to put it is that when John Major did it all those years ago, the trigger was Europe. It wasn't Brexit, but it was Britain's relationship with the European Union. And that is a long-running sore in British politics, particularly Conservative politics, over a generation. And this, though Brexit has raised the stakes enormously, this is part of that longer story.
May survived the vote. She got two-thirds of the vote. Most of the headlines that I've read describe that as not a great outcome for her. Helen, is that a fair characterization?
I think it's a fair characterization in terms of the politics of the moment, in the sense that what it showed is just how difficult it is for her to get this withdrawal act through the House of Commons. because you can kind of take numbers of Conservative MPs who wouldn't vote for Owen, the leadership, as the bare minimum who aren't going to vote for the Withdrawal Act as things stand. I don't think if you took that issue out of it, it would have been so bad for her, but it's kind of flushed out the number of opponents there are within the party of the Withdrawal Act in any form that it looks like at the moment.
Does this, for all intents and purposes, mean that the Brexit deal under consideration right now will not pass the House of Commons?
It won't pass unless something significant happens within the European Union and some reasonable concession from Theresa May's point of view is made to her by the EU27.
I mean, what could that be? David, if you want to weigh in, what could change in the conversation between the UK and the EU that would lead to some kind of agreement being passed through the House of Commons before the end of March?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this turns on the backstop, as it's called, but more broadly, what Brexit means for the island of Ireland and the relations between Northern Ireland and the Republic. And the key government here is the Irish government. I mean, the Irish government would need to sign off on any change to this deal, and so far the signals from Ireland have been that's not going to happen. And part of the complication here is that the Irish government, uniquely among other European governments, its reputation is at stake here too. It's very hard for the current Irish government to back down on this. I mean, my feeling about the result of the confidence vote is it was almost perfectly calibrated to resolve nothing. If a few more of her MPs had voted against her, she might have been weakened enough that she was really vulnerable. If a few fewer had voted against her, she might have been strengthened by it. This was almost the number at which we're back where we were.
This is a pretty basic question, but Theresa May's job right now seems almost like the worst job in Britain. Like, why does she even want this job? What's preventing her from saying, all right, you don't like what I've done? Take a vote on it. And if you don't want me here anymore, I'm out. Like, I have other things I could be doing instead of being yelled at by like everyone on every part of the political spectrum.
It is true. The big difference relative to a presidential system like yours is that prime ministers can resign. I mean, presidents don't resign. It's sort of unconstitutional in a way to resign. But prime ministers can and do resign when it becomes impossible. But this suits her character as well. And it is worth noting that though she is really hated by some sections of her own parliamentary party, her standing in the country with the public has probably gone up because her key characteristic is a kind of doggedness, a willingness to keep going. Some people almost see it as a kind of masochism. And this is playing to those strengths. I think people have been surprised, including some of her opponents in the party, by the extent to which the public haven't turned on her. I think people know who she is now. And I think at this point, people would be quite surprised if she resigned because almost not resigning has become her calling card.
I think that she's made a personal commitment to herself that she's going to endeavour to the end to try to deliver Brexit. She may fail, but I don't believe that she's at the point where she thinks that she's failed yet. And so long as there's any remote chance that she's the person who's going to be able to do this, having given, I think, what was a pretty personal commitment that she was going to honour the result of the referendum, is she will carry on.
What is her strategy at this point? How does she try to see a deal through the House of Commons?
I think that what she's trying to do is to persuade the EU27 that while they clearly are not going to agree to change the withdrawal agreement itself, that they might agree some kind of protocol which would make it clear that there is no realistic prospect of the backstop lasting for anything more than, say, a period of 6 months, but maximum a year. And then she's going to have to hope that that is enough for some of her backbenchers to think that whilst there's a legal problem with the backstop, that there isn't a political problem with the backstop.
I think the other part of her strategy is got to be time. The clock is ticking. There's a deadline to this, the 29th of March. The thing that there is clearly a significant fear of among a majority of members of Parliament is what is called no deal or a hard Brexit. As that gets closer to being a realistic possibility, she has at least the chance to focus minds. The danger for her is there is also a significant minority who want that outcome. And as that outcome becomes closer and closer, it gets worse if she doesn't prepare for it, and not preparing for it looks irresponsible. So it's complicated, but as we get closer to the moment of truth, some of the dynamics of this will change, particularly in the opposition party, the Labour Party. That's a crucial part of this. It's not just about what happens inside the Conservative Party. There are many Labour members of Parliament who would be very, very uncomfortable with a no-deal Brexit. And they're going to have some tough decisions to make as that becomes closer to reality.
David, you mentioned that perhaps May's standing with the British public had improved after the course of events. What kind of polling do we have about how they view May's job, but also just how they view this fundamental question of how to leave the European Union, whether to leave the European Union?
Yeah, I mean, I don't need to tell your podcast. A lot depends on what question you ask in the poll as to what kind of answer you get to that. There seems to be, on the range of polling, a small move on the part of the public, which voted 52-48 to leave, towards thinking that that was a mistake. So maybe, I mean, Helen could correct me this, but maybe there's a 5% shift among people who voted to leave who now might well vote remain. But you can read very little onto that as to what would happen in another referendum, because everything would depend then, again, what the question was on the referendum. Is it remain or hard leave? Is it Theresa May's deal or remain? Lots of different possibilities there. I think the underlying story is there hasn't been that much movement in public opinion on the basic question, remain or leave. And her standing has gone up in the sense, I think, she has the respect of people at a sort of personal level. But the one question that gets a clear majority answer, where people say yes, is, are you sick of Brexit? And people want it done in some sense. It's kind of swallowed up all the oxygen of British politics. It is technical. It's fantastically boring to most people. So there's a kind of building frustration there. Now, whether that frustration would manifest in people just saying, look, just do it, take whatever deal's on the table, or whether it would manifest in people saying, let's just scrap it, is another question.
Yeah, I think that there's basically is a three-way split between, I wouldn't want to put percentages on it, between those who are constituted both by Leave voters and Remain voters who want to leave the European Union with this deal, those who are constituted by Leave voters who want no deal because they think that this one's a betrayal, and those who were constituted by Remain voters, but not all Remain voters, who want either a second referendum or now, given the opportunity given by the European Court of Justice, simply want Article 50 revoked. Now, what that would turn out into, if you actually put that to another referendum, obviously in huge part is going to turn on whether you ask between two of those options or all of those options, and then what do you do about it? You're simply going to have the winner takes all, even though under three options, it's obvious that one of them isn't going to get to 50%. So it isn't even just, I think, a two-way split any longer in British politics. It's a profound three-way split.
And it is at least possible that Theresa May's deal, that has very few people in favour of it, nonetheless could win in a three-way vote if people were allowed to list a second preference. I mean, it's possible, I think it's almost certain, actually, that it would be most people's second preference, though it might be very few people's first preference. But there's never in British history been a referendum which is anything other than a straightforward binary question. We don't do three-way questions, never mind multiple voting systems.
So let's get into a little bit more about what this says about democracy and how our systems of government are holding up. But before we do that, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by Upstart Debt. Some people have a lot, some people have a little, and the vast majority of us have some. But trying to get on the path to financial freedom can look pretty bleak when you have high interest debt. And if your FICO score isn't great, it can make breaking out of that revolving debt cycle harder than it needs to be. Thankfully, Upstart is revolutionizing the process of personal lending. Upstart offers personal loans, but they're not like the ones your bank or credit union provides. That's because Upstart goes beyond the traditional FICO score when assessing your credit worthiness. For instance, they actually reward you based on your education and your job history in the form of a smarter interest rate. 2 minutes is all it takes to go online and find out your Upstart rate. Checking your Upstart rate is always free, and it won't affect your credit. Hurry to upstart.com/politics to find out how low your Upstart rate is. That's upstart.com/politics. All right, so we were just talking about how the British people would vote if given another opportunity to say how they feel. Is that anti-democratic? How is even the possibility of another vote on this issue viewed in Britain?
I think there's a lot of people who've wanted this right from the start, who are committed to Britain staying in the European Union, and have thought that the length of time that Article 50 negotiations take and the kind of precipice that they create at the end of it because of a deadline was going to be an opportunity to have a second referendum on the subject, and they've taken to calling it a people's vote. I think the problem with the idea that this can be put back to the electorate, though, is that everything that has happened in between, it's not like we would be taking another snapshot of what it is that people think about the question of whether Britain should be staying in or leaving the European Union. What the electorate has seen is a group of people well represented in the in the political class, but also in the professional middle class, who have spent a lot of time trying to ensure that the outcome of this period of politics that we're living through is that Britain doesn't leave the European Union. So that it's very difficult to see how a referendum can take place without the perception that it's been rigged in favour of staying in the European Union.
So the other complication here is that the event that would have intervened between a first and second referendum was a general election. So this Theresa May's predicament is the result of our last general election, which she tried to make a vote on Brexit. Her pitch was essentially, give me a big majority in Parliament and I'll be strengthened to get you a good deal in Brexit, to which the voting public said, well, we're not interested in that. We want to vote on the usual election issues, whether it's welfare or tax or schooling or health or whatever. And it became a domestic election. And the problem has always been to sort of plug this referendum result back into a domestic political situation where people at a general election voted on other issues. So Parliament is blocked and stuck partly because of that election, because it wasn't a Brexit election. And so we're going to, you know, the likelihood would go through another dance, another referendum, but there'd also then be another election because we'd almost certainly have a new government. And no one, I think, has worked out in this period since Brexit how you square the circle of referendum politics and British parliamentary politics. And that gap is just as wide as ever, not least because the people voted for something for which there is not a majority in Parliament.
Our audience is pretty familiar with us talking about the divides that exist in American politics. In American politics, probably more than in British politics, they're very demographic-based divides. What are the divides in British politics today? I mean, are they becoming more demographic? How would you characterize them in comparison to American politics?
I think they are similar, but with the caveat that that similarity was brought out by this referendum. So it's much starker with this referendum than with the party political system, where some of the old divisions hold. So one of the things this referendum brought out was a fundamental divide between metropolitan or urban areas and rural areas, between generations, old and young, a big divide around education, whether or not you went to college was the single biggest determinant of how you were likely to vote in the Brexit referendum. Now, that tended to be hidden by our two-party system, where the parties were, still are, quite complicated coalitions around these things. The referendum made it look stark. It's one of the reasons, I think, in lots of ways, people who run Brexit and Trump's election together are confusing two very different phenomena. But on this, those demographic divisions look strikingly similar to the divisions that were revealed by Trump's election.
Wait, so Helen, maybe jump in here. Where do the two strife? For people who compare the two as similar, why shouldn't we?
I think the difference is that I don't think that a lot of the divisions that have come out in Britain could really can really be fitted into kind of culture war narrative that has come to at least in part be used about American politics. I don't think that you can see, for instance, you know, like religion playing anything like the role that it does as a divisive way in American politics. And so I think that there is a divide that's expressed, if you like, between the provinces and London, and that's in some sense more important than metropolitan areas and London. And I think that makes it different from American politics, is we're not talking about coastal areas versus the middle. I think that London's role in this is a divisive, in some sense, is a divisive centre of power, of wealth, is much more important in the Brexit case than is sometimes recognised. And I think that there is a sense in which these are old political questions in Britain that have, if you like, have had to confront what are very contemporary political divides, including the educational divide, but also obviously divisions of opinion about immigration. You can tell a story about the divides of British politics, and they can have a very long history. They can go back centuries in terms of the Brexit question, in terms of what does Britain do in terms of its relations with Europe, and particularly as something that looks like a centralising European power. And you're going to struggle to explain that in terms of American politics and American divides. But there's something that's happened in Britain that has taken these long-standing historical questions and then plugged them in, if you like, into these contested political cleavages that we can see across Western democracies.
And just one other thing to add, the other big difference is that the Brexit divisions in British politics cut across divisions between nations. So there's a huge issue here about where Scotland fits in and whether the United Kingdom can hold together under certain conditions. And the fact that Scotland voted in a very different way from England and Wales, and then Northern Ireland, which is now the centre of the entire logjam, has a different political settlement from the rest of the UK. I don't think there are, I mean, of course, a federal system like the United States, there are all sorts of different political tensions at the state level, but this cuts across nationalism within the United Kingdom and what you could call the Scottish question, which also has a century-long history, has become acute under these conditions.
What lessons are there in Britain's experience with Brexit about the structural elements of its democracy? Like, is this the way the British system of government is supposed to be working?
No, it's not. That's a relatively easy one to answer.
So where is the dysfunction coming from? Because I think Americans also feel like Washington isn't functioning the way that it's supposed to. We generally blame it on partisanship, I would say. But, you know, money in politics, gerrymandering, all kinds of different elements of the structures of our democracy get blamed for that dysfunction. Where would you point the finger in Britain?
I think there are lots of things here, and Helen may have views that differ from mine. I think one feature of this is just the electoral system itself, a first-past-the-post system that tends to produce, is actually designed to produce, two parties that are rival parties for government, a party of government and a party of opposition. In a very fractured political landscape, it's hard to run all these divisions through those two parties. And so part of the dysfunction we have is a two-party system because of the way that our electoral system works, trying to cope with a whole range of overlapping divisions that make the parties themselves much harder to manage. The Labour Party is really struggling with Brexit too. The opposition party isn't well placed to present itself as an alternative party of government around this issue. So I think that is definitely a part of it. I think that has parallels with what's going on in the United States. I mean, I think it is striking that the recent things that people associate with democracy having gone wrong, if that's the way they look at it, the election of Donald Trump, Brexit, has happened in two-party systems. Multi-party systems have problems too. My God, European politics is not a model here. You wouldn't look at Italy, you wouldn't look at many places and say we should do it like that. But our particular dynamic here comes out of that. And just one more thing to finish on. I mean, there are, as Helen said, these long, long aspects to this story that go deeply into British history and also into the history of the last 30, 40 years in Britain's relationship with Europe. But some of the recent stuff is really contingent. I mean, there are ways it could have come out very differently. The referendum might not have happened. The referendum could have been won by the other side. Theresa May could have won a majority in the last election. I think we shouldn't overstate that this was all somehow predetermined. We've reached an impasse, a kind of perfect storm impasse, partly because of deep structural forces at work and partly through a series of accidents or contingencies. And I think we sometimes overstate the fact that it was always going to get to this point, and we forget the way that tweak a couple of things over the last couple of years, and British politics does not look the same today.
Right. Here at 538, we often impress upon people that a one-point victory is not so different from a one-point loss when it comes to actually analyzing what lies beneath.
Yeah, I think that there's clearly contingency because, you know, at the outset of the campaign, you might have said quite lightly that the Remain campaign would have won. I don't think, though, that would have actually taken the question away. We would have just been sort of kicking down maybe a few years the question of, like, Britain confronting its relationship with the European Union. I think there's two dysfunctional structural dynamics at work. The first is that when Britain entered the European community, as it then was in 1973, it never really found a way of reconciling it with its constitutional practices. That whole question was fudged by essentially saying Britain joining the European community wasn't a constitutional question. It was only a question of Britain's economic relations and particularly its trading relations with the European community. So in some sense, there always had to be a denial that there was anything constitutionally incompatible between membership of the European Union and the way in which the British constitution worked. I think the second thing that is kind of as playing itself out is the changes that were made to the British constitution in regard to the union. In the late 90s, under the Blair government, the giving devolution to Scotland and Wales and leaving the governance of England untouched. That left an English question in UK politics that kind of could be kept at bay so long as the New Labour were in power and there wasn't any tension between government of Westminster, government in Cardiff and government in Edinburgh. But once that wasn't the case, and once the Conservative Party, which is stronger
in England came back into government, then this question of what to do about the governance of England was going to come out. And in some sense, it has come out through the vote in England to leave the European Union.
Clearly, the system is facing some challenges. Where do you see things going from here?
I've got no idea, if you want my literal answer to that question. I think that anybody in Britain who tells you that they've got a clear idea what's now going to happen isn't really confronting the depth of the problem. There simply is insufficient political agreement within our constitutional arrangements for any of the three possible paths to be taken. I mean by that staying in the European Union, leaving the European Union with a withdrawal agreement, or leaving the European Union without one. None of those can command a majority in the House of Commons. And I don't think it would be possible, if you had a general election and elected a different House of Commons, that you would actually change that dynamic. So some side that has committed itself extremely strongly to a position is going to have to back down and in some sense be humiliated in order for us to get past where we are.
And no bets on who that might be.
I think that the people who haven't really been put to the test yet are the Labour leadership, because they have essentially been able to deal with Brexit as a tactical question about trying to oppose the Conservative government and trying to engineer circumstances that would lead to a general election and the possibility of Labour taking power itself. And the harder it becomes for them to realise that strategy, the more then that they're put into a position where they actually have to make a choice about what their position on leaving or not the European Union is. So I think that I wouldn't want to bet what they will then do, but I think that's the point that hasn't been pushed to breaking point yet.
Well, I guess only time will tell. It appears that they'll have to make up their minds by the end of March, unless, I mean, is there any way that that deadline could be kicked down the road?
There is a possibility that the UK could ask for an extension to Article 50, but it's pretty clear that the European Union would only agree that under certain conditions, one of which would be holding another referendum or quite possibly holding a general election. So that still doesn't in itself get us past the problem. There's almost certainly going to have to be a vote before the 21st of January in terms of the Withdrawal Act itself, because that's a parliamentary timetable that has been set out. So if we get to that point and this Withdrawal Act can't get through, then we will have moved on to another stage.
All right. Well, perhaps the two of you can come back and speak to us again once this is resolved, or once we reach that new stage where there's a new level of unknown and chaos in Britain.
Well, that would be good, Galen. Yeah. Happy to do so.
Fabulous. Well, Helen, thank you so much.
Thanks again, Galen, for asking us.
And thank you, David.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Helen Thompson is a professor of political economy at the University of Cambridge, and David Runciman is a professor of politics at Cambridge as well. They host the podcast called Talking Politics, which does a great job of talking about interesting questions surrounding politics around the world. I'm Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. Thanks again for listening, and we will see you soon.